من أمتي يعلم جميع علمي وفهمي وحكمتي غيره. So in the entire ummah, there is no one who knows all about the knowledge that I have, the understanding and wisdom that I have. And this is where I'll go back to the theme. Did Ali himself ever claim that or not? Again, we go to Sheikh Saduq in his Al-Amali.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Limelight. Israel and its cult in the United States have used every means to break the spirit of Palestinian defiance and to make Palestine a permanent colony of the Zionist regime. Washington has been a willful partner in Israel's schemes. The Al-Aqsa storm operation and the resistance it has generated have proven both delusional. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The venomous reach of Israeli cultism was demonstrated, for example, on March 25th, when U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, abstained from a Security Council vote on an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Administration officials then stated that the resolution, which passed with the U.S. abstention, was non-binding and unenforceable, giving the Zionist regime license once again to completely ignore UN resolutions. The deception behind the administration's vote to abstain is worth noting. The resolution was adopted under Chapter 6, Pacific Settlement of Disputes of the UN Charter. While Chapter 6 resolutions are commonly described as legally binding, there is no consensus on whether they are legally enforceable. The White House used this ambiguity to dismiss the resolution. Until the March votes to abstain, the first nominally serious act of the administration in the Security Council, the Biden administration has encouraged the Zionist regime's violation of international law and atrocities by vetoing four earlier Security Council ceasefire resolutions. Genocide is not a single act, but a process. In spite of the brutality, the Zionist regime's cultish minions continue to obfuscate and condone, refusing to recognize the historical context that led to the inevitability of October 7th. Nowhere is that more apparent than in the White House and in U.S. congressional news briefings and press conferences. Biden has been a friend of Israel since he entered Senate in 1973 and has often declared, "I am a Zionist." After receiving 5,736,701 dollars from 1990 to 2024 from pro-Israel lobby groups, his cultish mindset has hardened. A recent example of the president's dedication to the Zionist regime is the March 29th report that Biden secretly signed off on billions of dollars in additional bombs and warplanes for Israel. 1,800 2,000-pound bombs, 500 500-pound bombs, 25 F-35 fighter jets and engines worth $2.5 billion. He did this knowing that there is no place left to bomb but Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinians have been forced to flee, while the United States and the Zionist regime feign contention over Tel Aviv's planned ground invasion of Rafah. Israel has intensified air and artillery strikes on that beleaguered city. For over seven decades, America's top priority has been ensuring the safety of its citadel in the West Asia region. American administrations have spent billions propping up the West Asia despots, leaning on them to legitimize the Zionist regime's presence in the region. The Biden administration continues to plow recklessly ahead, even as Israel continues to provoke a wider war in the region, conducting lethal airstrikes into Lebanon and Syria. Since October 7th, the Biden administration has overtly committed the United States to the cultish ideology of destruction. On his March 22, 2024 trip to Tel Aviv, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken reiterated America's dedication to destroying the resistance group Hamas. Blinken asserted once again that the U.S. regime would work with the Zionist regime to destroy Palestinian resistance and nationalism. He and other American politicians failed to understand that the resistance group Hamas is an ideology that birthed a political resistance movement and cannot be destroyed. Israel and its cult in the United States have used every means to break the spirit of Palestinian defiance and to make Palestine a permanent colony of the Zionist regime. Washington has been a willful partner in the Zionist regime's schemes. The Al-Aqsa storm operation and the resistance it has generated have proven both delusional.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Sheikh Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudin was.
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan.
Mawlavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Quran.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly life of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries and scholars. I am Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Fadai and Shaykh Rouhani. Shaykh Fadai, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about an outstanding Shiite figure who was famous for his struggles against Ba'ath regime in Iraq and also Zionism in Palestine. He is no one but martyr or Shahid Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi. Shaykh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life biography and the education of Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi was born in 1952 in a city called Nabi Shaif, which is located in Baalbek, Lebanon. In 1966, in a city called Sur, he actually got familiar with Imam Musa Sadr, one of the other great outstanding figures in Lebanon. And of course, Imam Musa Sadr recommended him to go to Hawza Ilmiya, whose name was Ma'had al-Darasat al-Islamiya.
Yes.
And he started his Hawzawi or seminary kind of educations and learnings in that Hawza al-Ilmiya. And then in 1967, due to the continuation of his studies, he moved to Najaf al-Ashraf, and actually after studying there for levels of studies like Hawzawi kind of lessons.
Yes.
Then of course he took part into the lessons of Sayyid Ayatollah Khoui and yes. Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Sadr.
Yes.
And then of course he got more familiar with Shahid Sadr, and also step by step he got again familiar with the other great scholars and figures of Lebanon like Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah and the other Lebanese kind of scholars in Hawza al-Ilmiya.
That's all right. Okay. So Sheikh Fadai Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, we can say, started his education in Najaf in Iraq, and I think that the ideas of and the thoughts of Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr had direct effect on him in order somehow to be interested in the political Islam and also the establishment of a kind of Islamic government. That's why when he's back in Lebanon, now he's very much active in the political scene of Lebanon. Am I true?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, as you mentioned, he visited Shahid Sadr, Muhammad Baqir Sadr, Ayatollah Sadr, and Imam Khomeini in Najaf. At that time, Najaf was the main center of Hawza Ilmiya all over the world. Of course, even now, this Hawza exists as well. But now, we can say that Hawza of Qom is more powerful than Hawza of Najaf. But at that time, the main Hawza was Najaf. And in that city, a lot of scholars had classes teaching different students from various countries.
Yes.
But there were two different scholar and teacher there in Najaf at that time. One of them was Shahid Muhammad Baqir Sadr, and the other one was Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
The difference was that both of them had a revolutionary kind of thoughts.
Yes.
And both of them were theorists. They were not just kind of scholars who just copied the theories of the previous scholars and just teach it to other ones.
Yes.
They had no ideas in the different field of study, and as I told you, they were revolutionaries in their idea.
Okay.
Both of them tried to establish an Islamic state. So, first of all, with Shahid Muhammad Baqir Sadr, as he was his professor,
yes,
he could affect Sayyid Abbas Musawi, and after that he got familiar with Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
These two figures could form the characteristics of Sayyid Abbas Musawi,
yes.
And yes, we can say the first cause for this movement in Lebanon and Palestine, the first cause was Ayatollah Sadr. And after that, that's it right. was completed by getting familiar with Imam yes. Khomeini.
Okay. We know that the late Imam Khomeini on that time was concerned with his theory of Walayat al-Faqih. At the same time, Shahid Assad, through his books, was concerned with, for example, the book Islamuna or Iqtisaduna, yes. you know. And this na at the end of the words refers to something which belongs to Muslim,
yes.
We can say Islamic thoughts.
So that's na, the suffix na yes. means the real Islam.
It's Islam, that's right.
Not okay. something which is common in all
yes.
times.
Okay, that's right. And they were after, as you said, a kind of independent system of thought, and Abbas al-Musawi was nurtured under such ideas and thoughts. But Sheikh Rouhani, we'll get back to you, Sheikh Fadai, for more details about his life. As I said, when he is back to Lebanon, he starts his struggles and some of his struggles in Lebanon, especially the political ones. Give us a picture about the political arena of Lebanon on that time. How was it like?
You know, it seems that the people of Lebanon were at that time deprived of enough kind of facilities. They were suffering from poverty, particularly mm-hmm. the Shiite people in Lebanon. As a scholar, of course, he first of all actually paid attention to these problems that the people of Lebanon suffered at that time.
Yes.
So you know that any kind of political movement, it is first of all for meeting the demands of the society. When your people are suffering from different kind of problems, so as a Muslim scholar, he has this duty to actually try to solve these problems of the people. That's why they, together with some of the youth in Lebanon, they actually established a group of, resistance, we can say, to start resistance against Israel, because mm-hmm. they were of the view that these lots of these kind of political, economic, and social problems that the people of Lebanon suffered from. So the main cause was in Israel, and that's why they started the resistance, which was supported by people of Lebanon, and it led to establishment of Hezbollah, this party that later became the great political party in Lebanon.
Yes.
So of course, it was established by this Sayyid Abbas Musawi and mm-hmm. After Subhi Tufayli, who was the first Secretary General of yes. the Hezbollah, he took this position and became the Secretary General or the leader of this political movement in Lebanon.
That's all right. Of course, the main look and the perspective of the first and the second secretary generals of the Hezbollah were absolutely different, because some of them believed, in reconciliation with the Israeli powers, but the other ones are struggling against them. Sheikh Fadai, let's get to his selection as the secretary general of Hezbollah. How did it take place? And what were his main achievements during the deputyship of Hezbollah on that time?
You know, as my brother mentioned before, Sayyid Abbas Musavi, Sheikh Subhi Tufayli had this position,
yes.
But due to some problems in his ideas, because we can say some kind of belief in having conciliation with the enemy,
yes.
Which is not the real belief in Islam.
Yes.
In Islamic idea, we should be careful about how to define the term enemy, but after this definition, we don't have any reconciliation. The only thing is fighting with enemy. You know, when the enemy is something like Israel, the
yes.
fake regime of Israel,
yes.
if someone has even a little information about Israel, he can understand that there isn't any reconciliation with them. They just want to destroy everything. And Sayyid Abbas Musavi realized that from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe now it is easy to understand what is the identity of Israel. But at that time, for example, about 40 or 50 years ago, it was not so obvious for all people.
Yes.
Sayyid Abbas Musavi at that time realized that the only relationship with Israel
mm-hmm.
should be war and fighting.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Because they never get back. They want to destroy all the Islamic world. So it started to fight with Israel in the position of Secretary General.
Yes.
And at that time, we can say that this kind of idea to fight with Israel completely without any reconciliation, we can say that he got it from one of his professors, Sheikh Raghib Harb, and
yes.
of course, friend. Sheikh Raghib Harb, which was mounted by Israeli regime some years ago, started this movement in Lebanon
mm-hmm.
to fight Israel. And Sayyid Abbas Musavi tried to continue this movement. It's interesting to know that in the 8th anniversary of Sheikh Raghib, Sayyid Abbas Musavi was martyred as well.
Mm-hmm.
There was a ceremony for the
okay.
anniversary
yes.
of the martyrdom of Sheikh Raghib Harb. And after this ceremony, because the Israeli regime realized the impact of Sayyid Abbas
uh-huh.
Musavi, and
okay.
they knew that he can be, and he is the second Raghib
yes.
Harb,
yes.
They decided to kill Sayyid Abbas Musavi. And it is interesting to know that he was martyred with his
okay.
wife
okay.
as one of his child. And his wife, before his martyr, before her martyrdom, said, "If Sayyid Abbas want to be martyr, I want to be martyr with him
mm-hmm.
together."
Yes.
And that is a real Islamic belief
okay.
in a family.
And this has been the way of the Israelis, I mean, doing assassination. Always and always, and still today, we could see that through assassination and genocide in Palestine, they are killing so many people. That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani. We want to finish today's program with the voice of Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi himself speaking in Arabic language along with the English translation. Let's listen to that and then we'll finish our program. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher on the Life Account of Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi. For more information, visit our website at parstudy.ir, Court of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman.
Go ahead and kill us. For indeed, our nation will become more and more aware. The enemy might keep slaughtering us, yet we, who are on the path of Imam Khomeini, we believe in the principle that this Imam enacted. Go ahead and kill us. For indeed, our nation will become more and more aware.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
The Palestine Chronicle spoke with two journalists and a resident from Gaza who witnessed the devastation caused by the Zionist regime bombing on the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, 6 months of the Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza have made millions of people displaced. According to United Nations figures, as of January, a staggering 85% of the total population of Gaza, 1.9 million civilians, had been forcibly displaced by the Zionist regime's military operations. The situation in the makeshift refugee camps across the Gaza Strip is catastrophic, with medical sources raising the alarm about the spread of diseases, particularly among children. Unfortunately, even living in a tent amid extreme hardship does not guarantee safety, as no place has been safe in the Gaza Strip since the beginning of the Zionist regime's assault on October 7th. On March 31st, Israeli regime bombs targeted a group of tents set up for journalists inside the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in the central city of Deir al-Balah. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with two journalists and a resident from Gaza who witnessed the devastation caused by the Zionist regime bombing. Palestinian journalist Ayman Shama told the Palestine Chronicle it was a Sunday morning, half an hour before the noon prayer, when we were surprised by the Israeli shelling. They bombed the gate of the reception and emergency department inside the hospital. At least two people were killed and many others wounded. Ambulances and dozens of tents were damaged, along with some parts of the hospital. He continued, they targeted the vicinity of the tents of journalists, where live broadcasts are carried out to cover the arrival of martyrs and injuries to the hospital. From there, journalists also communicate live with their channels in a desperate attempt to convey the suffering of the people of Gaza, expose the crimes of the occupation, and spread the Palestinian voice to the world. In the attack, dozens of tents were burned or damaged, and many displaced people were scattered. He said, hospitals are not safe. No place is safe to everyone in Gaza. Palestinian journalist Mohammad Al-Khatib told the Palestine Chronicle, during these 6 months of war, the occupation bombed houses very close to the hospital, and Apache helicopters fired at the displaced people inside the complex, but we did not expect the Israeli occupation forces to directly bomb the hospital compound and kill displaced people within the hospital walls, he said. Al-Khatib explained, "This is a new crime committed by the occupation, which should be included in the trial for genocide before the International Court of Justice." Hassan Nofal is a young resident from Gaza. Since his sister was seriously injured 4 months ago, he and his family embarked on a desperate journey to look for safety. Nofal told Palestine Chronicle, "My sister was seriously injured during the shelling of her husband's house for over 4 months ago. We fled with my family, my injured sister, and my younger brother, who suffers from a severe disability, to the European hospital in the eastern part of the southern city of Khan Yunis city. After the Zionist regime invasion of Khan Yunis, however, the family moved again." He explained, "We brought my sister with us and set up a tent inside the Al-Aqsa hospital, where my injured sister received treatment inside the tent." Nofal said, "On March 31st, my mother and my injured sister traveled to receive treatment. I stayed in a tent with my younger sister and my disabled brother. The bombing targeted a tent very close to ours, but we were spared injury." He added, while still in a very emotional state, "The bombing caused a state of fear and panic among all the displaced people." Nofal lamented, "All the displaced people inside the hospital are either injured or patients who need to be close to the hospital to receive treatment. What the occupation is doing in Gaza is beyond human imagination."
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, what can we learn now that the holy month of Ramadan is over and it is Eid? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So the holy month of Ramadan is now in the past. You know, it was such a beautiful month. We had so many different blessings. We learned so many different lessons. Now that the holy month of Ramadan is over, we are a little bit sad that this beautiful and auspicious month has come to an end. And you know, how we wish and we would have loved for the blessings and the spiritual elevation and the spiritual ecstasy, if you will, that we were feeling and experiencing in the holy month of Ramadan. We wish how this would have never ended and it would have continued. Perhaps that's why the holy month of Ramadan is only 30 days long, right? Or 29 or 30 days long, is so that, you know, after it is done, we learn to appreciate this holy month of Ramadan and we look forward to next year's holy month of Ramadan. If these blessings and these spiritual ecstasy was, you know, there throughout the whole year, then there would have not been anything special about the holy month of Ramadan. So we learned a whole bunch of different things. We experienced a whole bunch of different things. These positive blessings, these spiritual vibes, you know, this spiritual ecstasy, these rewards
both that we will witness in this world and the next, this spiritual healing and purification that we went through, all of these different things that we were able to achieve and acquire in the holy month of Ramadan. Well, these things, they make us happy, that may Allah accept our worship and our obedience, you know, our servitude, you know, and all of the acts of worship, fasting and prayers and du'as that we did in this holy month of Ramadan. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So the holy month of Ramadan has ended. You know, we are sad on one hand because this divine companion has left. On the other hand, we are happy that inshallah, we have hope that Allah has accepted this month of fasting from us all over the world. Now, we find that the Imams also, along with being a little bit sad because the holy month of Ramadan has ended, you know, they were also incredibly happy on the day of Eid. And on the day of Eid, they would not only themselves wear beautiful clothes and perfume themselves and go and greet one another and the other Muslims and congratulate them, you know, because they successfully passed a great test, inshallah. And they also, what I was saying was that not only did they do this themselves, they encouraged the Muslims to do the same. And so, you know, on the day of Eid, hopefully we did go and, you know, met the other believers and went to the Eid prayers and wore nice clothes and perfumed ourselves. But just, you know, as we end the program and time is running out, let us not break all of the rules and all of the things that we learn in the holy month of Ramadan. Sometimes we make this mistake on the day of Eid, is that we let loose and we totally break all of the religious rules. This is most definitely a deception by shaitan. So please be careful and remember that the holy month of Ramadan, the way that you lived at that time is the way that you should be acting and behaving on the day of Eid as well.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The limelight. Donald Trump's campaign has said it has raised $50.5 million at a fundraising event in Florida, a staggering sum as the former president's political operation scrambles to close its big financial gap with President Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump's campaign said it has raised $50.5 million at a Saturday 6th of April event in Florida, marking a massive haul as his campaign looks to catch up to the Biden campaign's recent fundraising efforts and significant cash advantage. the record-breaking sum that the campaign reported raising at a Palm Beach, Florida fundraising dinner on Saturday, 6th of April, far surpasses the amount brought in by a star-studded fundraiser for the Biden campaign last month. As the GOP touted the event as an indicator of the party's unity behind former President Donald Trump. In a joint statement, the Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Whatley and co-chair Laura Trump said the success of Saturday's event is proving what we already know. Americans are fed up with Biden's record of failure, from the open southern border and sky-high inflation to the migrant crime crisis that has made everyone less safe. The funds raised at Saturday's fundraiser are expected to be split between the Trump campaign, the Republican National Committee, state Republican parties, and the Save America PAC, which helps pay for the former president's legal bills. The reported influx comes as Trump's fundraising efforts have been steadily increasing since November, as his path to the nomination has become clearer. But it's fallen short of the Biden campaign and the Democratic Party's fundraising efforts as the two men prepare to face off in the autumn. The Biden campaign said on Saturday, 6th of April, that the president raised over $90 million in March, coming $25 million above what Trump brought in during the period. Joe Biden had ramped up his campaign effort during the month, traveling to battleground states following his State of the Union address. And a private New York City fundraiser during March with former presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton brought in more than $26 million in a single night, according to Biden's campaign. But the Trump campaign touted Saturday night's figures as outpacing the Democrats' efforts. It took three Democratic presidents to raise $25 million and one president to raise over $50 million, Donald J. Trump, campaign spokesperson Daniel Alvarez said. Heading into the night, Donald Trump himself trumpeted the expected fundraising influx, calling it the biggest night in fundraising ever, while noting that it would eclipse the recent Biden fundraising efforts. The Palm Beach, Florida dinner, which was held at the home of investor John Paulson, featured remarks from the former President Donald Trump, who highlighted the need to win back the White House and pledged to make the country bigger, better, and stronger than ever before, according to senior campaign officials. The event also included remarks from North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum and entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy. CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story. Donald Trump's campaign said it has raised $50.5 million at a Saturday, 6th of April fundraiser in Florida, a staggering sum as the former president's political operations scrambles to close its big financial gap with President Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. The haul announced by the campaign and top officials with the Republican National Committee far eclipses the $26 million that Joe Biden reportedly collected recently at a star-studded gathering in New York City that featured former Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. The Trump total from the inaugural leadership dinner at the Palm Beach, Florida, home of billionaire investor John Paulson, sets a record for a single fundraising event. It's clearer than ever that we have the message, the operation, and the money to propel President Trump to victory on 5th of November, Trump campaign senior advisors Chris LaCivita and Susie Wiles said in a statement. Donald Trump delivered a traditional campaign speech to wealthy donors at the fundraising event, highlighting core issues that he wants to focus on in his second term in office: extending his 2017 tax cuts, securing the southern border with Mexico, and ending Biden's electric vehicle mandates. The closed-door dinner hosted at the home of billionaire investor John Paulson signaled that some of the GOP's biggest donors are rallying behind Donald Trump as the general election showdown with Joe Biden swings into gear. Trump, who sat between Paulson and former First Lady Melania Trump, spoke from the head table for roughly 45 minutes. President Trump spoke on the need to win back the White House so we can turn our country around, focusing on key issues including unleashing energy production, securing our southern border with Mexico, reducing inflation, extending the Trump tax cuts, and eliminating Joe Biden's insane electric vehicle mandate. The Biden campaign criticized Donald Trump for the high-dollar fundraiser, saying he's not fighting for ordinary Americans. Donald Trump spent his entire presidency lining the pockets of the wealthy, tax avoiders like himself, at the expense of the middle class, Biden campaign spokeswoman Sarafina Chitika said in a statement. The American people deserve a president that fights for the Main Street, not Wall Street. An array of wealthy GOP figures were billed as event co-chairs, including hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer, oil tycoon Harold Hamm, hotelier and space entrepreneur Robert Bigelow, and casino mogul Steve Wynn. The price tag for the fundraiser ranged from $250,000 per person for those serving on the host committee to $824,000 per person to serve as a chairman. Perks for those contributing at the top level included dinner seating at Donald Trump's table. But Donald Trump has lots of ground to make up in the fundraising race. Joe Biden and the Democratic Party on Saturday announced raising more than $90 million in March and entering April with some $192 million in available cash in their war chest. The Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee announced raising a combined $65.6 million in March and said they closed the month with $93.1 million in cash on hand. The Palm Beach, Florida fundraiser collected money for the Trump 47 Committee, a joint fundraising operation that includes Trump's campaign, the Republican National Committee, and state party committees. It also benefited a leadership PAC that has underwritten Donald Trump's personal legal bills and is part of the joint fundraising agreement. English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
مجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the first sermon delivered on April 22nd, 2023 by Imam Khamenei the leader of the Islamic Revolution, at the Eid al-Fitr prayer in Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah alayhi, Musalla in Tehran. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds. Praise be to Allah, who created the heavens and the earth, and made darkness and light. Yet those who reject faith hold others as equal with their Lord. The Quran, chapter 6, verse number 1. We praise you, seek your help, beseech you, seek your forgiveness, and send peace and greetings upon your beloved, the master of your creation, Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad, and upon his pure, immaculate, infallible household, the chosen guides, especially the remnant of God on earth. And peace be upon the imams of the Muslims, those who protect the oppressed and guide the faithful. I congratulate all faithful Muslim brothers all over the world and the great nation of Iran and you who pray on the blessed occasion of Eid al-Fitr.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I congratulate you on spending a fruitful month of Ramadan full of divine generosity this year. The month of Ramadan this year was a very delightful and lively Ramadan. In this month, there was prayer, supplication, and tawassul, intercession, especially on the blessed nights of Qadr. Keeping all-night soul-stirring vigils by the youths, and the warm tears that trickled out of the blessed eyes of our pure young people were truly outstanding. Meetings and gatherings of teaching and learning spiritual lessons, Quran meetings and recitations of the Quran in all parts of the country were, thank God, more outstanding than ever before during this year. The presence of people in martyrs, flower gardens, martyr ceremonies, in gatherings, in religious groups, and in mosques was a noticeable presence. The faithful help that people provided in this month, helping orphans, the needy, and the poor, I mean one of the most important duties in the month of Ramadan is this public presence and being by the side of the underprivileged and the poor.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
¡Es caneta que son!
As India prepares to hold the world's largest electoral exercise from April 19, the main opposition National Congress Party has said the country will lose its secular democratic credentials if the ruling BJP attains power another term, accusing Prime Minister Modi's party of dictatorship. In its election manifesto, the party has promised to boost social spending, saying Modi's ruling party has favored the interests of only the rich. The opposition party promised to uplift the marginalized if it comes to power. Pre-election polls, however, predict Modi sweeping back for a third term. Election results will be declared on June 4th.
Most Indians have realized that only Congress Party can do good for poor and minorities, which is what democracy means. The country is divided today due to politics of division just for votes.
India's main opposition party, which ruled the country for decades, has been struggling to compete with Modi's ruling BJP, which mainly counts on country's largest Hindu majority population for its vote share. The Congress Party, while releasing its election manifesto, has promised more help for the marginalized, including assured jobs for young, improving farmers' income, and better health insurance payouts. The Congress Party accused Modi's BJP of threatening the Constitution.
Our party has been crippled using tax agencies. Is it level playing ground? This is not only Congress Party. They will also do same with media houses. So we need to save democracy and Constitution. We have to unite against autocratic policies of the BJP government.
Accusing Modi's BJP of crippling his party by freezing its bank account in tax dispute, the opposition party manifesto has vowed to undo BJP policies if the party comes to power, promising that all anti-people laws passed by the ruling BJP without proper democratic process will thoroughly be reviewed and changed, including a much-debated electoral bond controversy. The party is sure to address issues related to minorities, communal conflicts, mob lynching and cattle killings, bulldozer politics and suppression of human rights and shrinking dissent. The Congress Party, the main challenger to the BJP, hopes to mount a challenge to Modi's BJP by joining hands with regional parties. The ruling party has, however, downplayed Congress Party's manifesto as a bundle of lies, saying they ruled for 50 years, which is now a divided house of leaders working for personal interests.
In 2014, Modi's ruling BJP gained popularity among India's Hindu majority, promising revolutionary changes in the country, including a crackdown on corruption and economic prosperity. Critics, however, argue another term for the ruling BJP would undermine India's status as a secular democracy, as the ruling party's broader agenda is to transform India into a Hindu supremacist nation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Highly politicized French polling agencies have rarely dared to make surveys on Palestine, but after 6 months of attempted genocide, a new poll shows public opinion dramatically shifting against Israel. Since October, support for Israel's plan to eliminate Hamas has dropped from 65 to 56%, while condemnation for Israel's war aim has jumped from 35 to 44%. Following the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, France had become an ardently pro-Zionist country. But the polls show that a nation evenly split on support for Palestine isn't far away.
Here in France, we have many stars and actors who are Arabs and Muslims, but who don't say a word about Palestine and who don't support the Palestinian cause openly. It's a shame because they could have a big impact on the French public. Instead, they shut themselves up.
Israel est illégitime.
Israel is illegitimate and has no right to exist. Palestine is unjustly occupied, and I don't see how anyone can fail to see that. I'm waiting for Iran and Hezbollah to do their work and for Israel to get out.
As Palestinians return to the city of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, the results of 6 months of war are catastrophic. Israel has killed over 33,000 people and wounded 80,000 others in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. Famine is affecting half of Gaza's 2.2 million people, while some two-thirds of the nation's buildings have been reduced to rubble.
This war really has to stop. People are forgetting that the Palestinians are humans, just like everyone else. There are just horrible things going on for women and children. And there has to be peace immediately.
After 6 months, the United Nations Human Rights Council finally took a position on the horrific invasion. They called for a halt in all arms sales to Israel and for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity. Many attribute the Western public's shift against Israel not to the mainstream media or brave politicians, but to the gruesome and heartbreaking images being relayed on social and alternative media. Images of the human costs of the West's support for Tel Aviv have long been censored. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Afghanistan is now battling an invisible foe that threatens its future generations. The World Food Program has sounded the alarm on the rising tide of malnutrition cases, a crisis worsened by the country's ongoing economic challenges and reduced international aid. Marking the World Health Day, the Taliban's Minister of Public Health expresses concern over the malnutrition crisis, calling for international support.
It is clear that Afghanistan is one of the poor countries in the world. There is no doubt that children and mothers are grappling with malnutrition. We need the support of the world in combating the disaster. I call on the UNICEF, WHO and WFP to continue the